Welcome to Pulp Tales, fascinating stories of the pulp magazines and the creative minds that brought them to life. The fictioneers, the artists, the editors, and others. Brought to you by the PulpNet. Learn more about the pulp magazines through articles, blogs, bibliographies, links, over 100 episodes of this podcast, and much more at the PulpNet. Your link to the pulp magazines for almost 30 years. Online at thepulp.net.
While all this is going on, the Ellsworth shift has really happened. And it was a revelation to me when I got into the Tony Key stories working for Matt, because you might have the first two chapters of a Tony Key story inside the head of some secondary character. You might not even get Tony Key introduced until the third or fourth chapter. And this was kind of the way, if you start looking at the way the hard-boiled things changed, not to a softer-boiled thing necessarily, but to a more internal monologue or internal motivation rather than external. Think of D.L. Champion. Think of Allhoff. Think of Mariano Mercado, those characters.
In this episode of Pulp Tales, John Gunnison, proprietor at Adventure House, author John Woolley, and pulp collector and dealer John McMahon discuss how the classic detective pulp, Black Mask, changed after it was purchased by popular publications. This Pulp Tales was recorded at Pulp Fest 2024 in Pittsburgh on Friday, August 2nd, 2024. John Woolley begins.
Thank you all very much for coming, and we want to mention before we go into the popular years, the great panel that Walker did, and Ed did yesterday evening about the Black Mask years before popular. There was a transitional figure there I'd like to talk about before you start into the popular years, and that was an editor named Fanny Ellsworth. Now, Fanny Ellsworth was, some people call it, has been called the Ellsworth shift, in which the objective external motivations for characters became internal, became more psychological. And this was, a lot of people said this was because of Fanny Ellsworth, the editor. Steve Fisher, in the, I just did the introduction for the Matt Morin's new Tony Key book, collection of Steve Fisher stories, and have a lot about Fanny Ellsworth and the Ellsworth shift, because Steve Fisher was one of the big proponents of it, as was your father, Peter Page, as was, Frank Gruber, and D.L. Champion, and Cornell Woolrich are some of the people who are mentioned that were in that whole Ellsworth shift. Now, Fanny Ellsworth did not follow Black Mask to popular, but she had started, she sort of laid the groundwork before that for what Black Mask became under popular.
And we'll go over more of that here in just a little bit.
Okay. Is that all you have to say?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Man of few words and even fewer ideas.
So, all right, so what were the reasons? Let's go ahead and start out. What were the reasons that Pop Warner, who was the business manager of Pro Distributors, why did they sell Black Mask to Popular? Popular's first issue, by the way, was June 1940. First issue of the Popular Black
Mask. So what's up on the screen is the last, as it says, the last Pro Distributors issue, April of 1940. And shot of Pop Warner going after any of his authors that wanted him to pay.
Now, he had some sales figures, didn't he?
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, we can see here under Pro Distributors in the last year of what they did, it was a 15-cent magazine. And you can see that even it went up to 20 cents towards the end. And you can see on the second column of the circulation numbers. Now, these all come from ABC, which is Auto Bureau of Circulation. Now, these aren't necessarily all sold issues, but this is what they reported, because they would report these figures to ABC, who would then publish them, and then when they would get ad rates, they would be based on the number of copies that were being published. So you can see that's why it says source ABC. anyway, so you can see Fanny Ellsworth throughout. And the numbers are okay, I guess. Nowhere near that they were in the 20s during the Hammett reign, where they were selling well over 100,000 copies every single issue. And here are some of those, again, those historical figures in which you have, take for instance, the fourth one down, you have 124,000 copies, and look who's in that issue. Horace McCoy, Raoul Whitfield, Earl and Marion Scott, Dashiell Hammett, L.R. Sherman, Earl Stanley Gardner, and Rusty Rayhart. You can see those numbers are beginning to drift downwards. Of course, you know, you have prior to the stock market crash, you had 20-cent magazines, and that was typical for all the pulps. Almost everything was pretty much 20 cents, except for Argosy, which was 10 cents. But then, you know, the numbers start to drop pretty precipitously. Considering you look at 1939, they were selling half the issues they were in 1931. And you can see all the names, and they were definitely very much the class of detective writers back then. We move on to
Fictioneers. Okay, so just about the time that Popular bought Black Mask, the Fictioneers Incorporated imprint was getting started at Popular. Basically, what Fictioneers was, as nearly as we can tell, and there's a lot of different sort of takes on this, Fictioneers was the lower priced market. It was kind of like, I think in the introduction to the Tony Key book, it's kind of like RCA and RCA Camden, you know, I mean the albums, right? And you had the major imprint, and then you had the cheaper imprint, although they weren't sold any cheaper, so that analogy breaks down there. But, so we're not entirely sure why Fictioneers, Black Mask was brought in not under Popular Publications, but under Fictioneers.
Yeah, you'll see on this cover, which was the first issue of Black Mask under Popular. You will not find the colophon for Popular anywhere on the cover. Unfortunately, it doesn't show right now. It's a little too dark on this image. All it is a simple F in a circle, and that was Fictioneers' logo. So, you know, a speculation can be they bought it. Dime Detective was Steiger's baby, as he said many years ago at a PulpCon. They were losing money hand over fist when they first started. And he would relate about the secretary. If someone came in trying to get paid for like the printer or whatever was trying to get paid, she'd give them a signal and they'd go running down this back entrance or exit to the pool hall down on the first floor, and they'd sit around there playing pool until they got the high sign to be able to come back. And he said the only magazine that made money was the first time they came out with Dime Detective. And if you think about it, the title was the reason, because all their titles were 20 cents, and Dime Detective was the change.
We might also say, we were talking about this earlier, John, might also say that Fictioneers was generally considered a half-cent a word market, whereas Popular was a cent a word. I mean, that's just a standard. However, one of the speculations has been that they paid their top writers that top money. What was it for?
4 cents a word when they brought them over from Black Mask.
When they brought them, yeah, 4 cents a word. And then maybe the guys that were filling in only got to half cent a word, but we're just really not sure. As we were talking before we came on, we tend to romanticize or glamorize what went on in these publishing houses, but they were all business decisions. They were all making business decisions. They weren't aesthetic or artistic decisions, they were businesses.
And they worked on very, very thin margins.
Very thin margins indeed, yeah.
Yeah, there was a talk that Steiger and David Polkoff many years ago talking about, and he made things up, quite honestly, because I think we're all romanticizing about it. But someone asked him the question, why did Dr. Yen Sin only last 3 issues? And he said, well, that's because we found out that the word yen sin meant sex in Chinese.
It's a good story, though, isn't it?
No. I mean,
well, you know, Kenneth White, after Fanny Ellsworth, Kenneth White was the editor of Black Mask at Popular or at Fictioneers. He'd been the editor of Dime since at least May of 36, may have actually been the de facto editor before that, because Steger was the official editor, but he may have assigned him that job. And my question to you guys, actually, I'd like to know, do you think that that Kenneth White intentionally set up Black Mask to, or Dime, rather, to be a clone of Black Mask when he first started?
Well, I was the parent when he basically stole as many Black Mask writers as he possibly could by buying away from Black Mask to work for Dime Detective.
That's true.
I mean, yeah. He offered a higher rate to get him over there, and then he'd create new characters.
And I'm sure he would have gone after Hammett if Hammett was still writing
exactly,
in the 30s, yeah.
Like you and Walker's boy, Carol John Daly, Race Williams. We know how Walker enjoys a good Race Williams story.
On its second, third, and fourth reading.
Exactly.
And how do they smell? Do they smell any different from Walker?
Oh, that pulp paper is good. Every title had its own scent.
And we're not talking about C-E-N-T. So.
Exactly right. So they did start out with a little bit of horror and weird menace con.
Right.
We're talking about with Dime.
Very quickly.
They quickly
transcend.
Well, we still have a 1936 issue here in which some damsel is about ready to have her head lopped off. I mean, that was definitely Steger's way of titillating the audience. And you got to remember, after the stock market crash, that's when pulps completely changed their art direction, and they started going to much more lurid covers compared to the more staid covers prior to the stock market crash.
So and
you'll see the Black Mask again here, February of 41, not quite a year in, it's still a Fictioneer's pulp. You do not find Popular on the cover.
And yet Kenneth White was also editing Popular.
Yes.
Right, so there you go. Does anybody want to talk about Kenneth White's pulp lineage? You know, he was a second generation, right?
Well, you probably know that better than we do.
You put the book on it.
I don't think I did, but yeah. His dad then was the adventure editor, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, thank you. And Kenneth White really didn't care for pulps for a long time, but it was one of those deals where he went into the family business. And when he did, as John talked about, he lured a bunch of authors away from Black Mask, including, once again, Race Williams. And the reason we keep talking about Race Williams is because as Walker and Ed talked about last night, anytime you had Race Williams on the cover of an early Black Mask, the readership shot up. The sales shot up.
15%.
15%. Yeah, so there you go. Although nobody in the business, the editors didn't really care for him, the people loved him.
Well, interesting enough, John, that when Carol John Daly came over to Dime Detective, he created a new character called V. Brown.
Yep.
And then later on, when they got to a payment dispute with Black Mask, he brought over Race Williams, who was published in Dime Detective, not Black Mask.
And first shows up in Dime, well, as his last, as I happen to have it here, November 34th was his last Black Mask, Pro Distributors Black Mask for Race Williams. September 35, he's in Dime.
In Dime.
Stays there till 49. Then bottom dropped out a little bit. He goes to Popular Detective, Thrilling Detective. You can kind of count that bounce downward. Ends up Race Williams in the 1952 smashing detective stories. Bottom of the barrel. That was Clayton.
No, that's not Clayton.
It's not Clayton? I thought it was Clayton.
No.
That Clayton was long gone by then.
Columbia,
not Clayton. Columbia. I'm sorry. Yeah, oh, we got hecklers.
Silver Clayton, yes.
Yeah. It was Columbia, not Clayton, my fault. Yeah, so he did have in the Black Mask, the Fictioneer's Black Mask, he had a couple of Pete Hines stories. Have you read those? Do you know the Pete Hines story?
Yeah, I have. The same old nonsense.
First person?
Yeah.
Like Race, addressing the audience?
Not as much. He'd slap enough around and figured. Change a little bit of pace by that time.
Okay.
Well, or he tried anyway, didn't he? But he basically kept Race Williams.
Right.
The market changed in ways. Race Williams stayed the same, even though he had been really the fair-haired boy at Black Mask early on.
Maybe and the thing was, no one liked him, as they pointed out the other day, no one liked Race Williams. No one liked Carroll John Doe.
Except the people.
Except the people who bought it.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, that's what counted.
That's yeah. Right. That's right. All right, you got the next one here?
Kenneth White, we actually went over, and I should, but you can see Earl Stanley Gardner way up to the right. Now, yeah, Gardner was still writing for Black Mask as at the same time he was writing for Dime, correct?
Yes.
Yes. And Carroll John Daly, very erudite picture there of Carroll John Daly.
He does look erudite.
Yeah. And then you have, again, a December of 41 issue of Black Mask, that's the fiction years. And again, we can only speculate that they did not want to have Black Mask in direct competition with Dime Detective, thinking that it's from the same publisher. So
you've got, while all this is going on, the Ellsworth shift has really happened. If you read, for instance, and it was a revelation to me when I got into the Tony Key stories working for Matt, because you might have the first two chapters of a Tony Key story inside the head of some secondary character. You might not even get Tony Key introduced until the third or fourth chapter. And this was kind of the way, if you start looking at the way the hard-boiled things changed, not to a softer boil thing necessarily, but to a more internal monologue or internal motivation rather than external. Think of D.L. Champion. Think of Allhoff. Think of Mariano Mercado, those characters. And who am I missing? Rex Sackler. And
Robert Reeves.
Robert Reeves.
Smith, yeah.
If Robert Reeves, I really believe, and you guys probably, if you've read Robert Reeves, I think you probably agree, if he hadn't been killed in war, he would have been a powerful figure in detective fiction. He already was doing books. But anyway, he was killed very early in the war, as I understand it, very early in World War II. So he was one of them that we brought over. Cleve F. Adams, who had the crankiest detective who ever lived. Well, maybe Allhoff was crankier.
Yeah.
But Lieutenant Canavan, just an absolute crank. And he was another one that came over during the Ellsworth shift. I believe that Cash Whale, Peter Page's character, was hugely, hugely hard-boiled. He's one of the most hard-boiled characters. The one got a manhole-sized chip on his shoulder, manhole cover-sized chip on his shoulder. And yet, his motivation is many times internal and not external. And that's what we have. Ellsworth's shift moves to Black Mask when it's with Popular.
What I got next here? Oh, there he is. Okay, there's some Martin Wilson
people. And you can see, though, now in September 42, even though it's still listed on the Indicia as Fictioneers, we finally have the Popular logo popping up on the magazine. Again, a lot of publishers did different had different publishers named. Goodman had about a million different publishers for every single magazine they ever or comic book they ever published.
One of the things that you look at between the relationship between Black Mask and Dime is the characters or the writers that were writing for both of them. Now, the Marquis of Broadway from Dime Detective, John Lawrence's character, in Black Mask, it was the Broadway Squad. So Marty Marquis, for those, the Marquis of Broadway was just this tough little guy that they were really sort of fascist and in a lot of ways, and were very tough and very, unrelenting in their pursuit of justice or what they thought if someone had messed up in some way. You go over to Black Mask, and instead of the Marquis of Broadway, it's the Broadway Squad, but it's different members of the Broadway Squad are the stars of the stories in Black Mask. So you've got a real connection, especially with John Lawrence and the Broadway Squad. And there's others as well, of course, because D.L. Champion was showing up in both of them. I can't remember which one Rex Sackler was in and which one, you know, which one Marilyn Mercado was in. And yeah, and I know Allhoff was a dime guy, but yeah. So there's all that. There was all that going back and forth. So yeah. What's next?
John D. McDonald.
Oh, not yet. No,
I know.
You're way toward the end.
Not yet. Right, exactly.
Okay.
Keep on going.
Oh, thank you. All right. Apparently, according to William F. Nolan, Cap Shaw, Joseph T. Shaw, re-entered the Black Mask picture in 1944 as an advisor to new writers. What did that mean? Because he was an agent at the time. In fact, he was Peter Page's agent. So here's an agent who is advising new writers. It seems real kind of almost incestuous, doesn't it? I mean, it's like, yeah, the whole idea that an agent is also working for the magazine that buys the stories that he's agenting.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Angel.
I'm just thinking out loud, if you really, that's speculation, but if you want those guys to write for you, get the agent on board.
Good point.
Well, and I was asking Doug Ellis, back when he invited Fred Pohl to come to Windy City and have a talk, he became an editor of some of the Fictioneers science fiction magazines. And what he would do is he would write stories, he would reach out to his friends of his that would write stories. You know, it was completely incestuous in that respect. So, you know, you become a friend of either the editor or you know, perhaps the agent who was then getting stories into those magazines.
Well, I also understand that when, and I can't remember the year, some of you guys may know the year, the year that Hardboiled Omnibus came out, the Capshaw's collection, it was in the 40s, I know, 40s. Later 40s, like 46.
46.
Uh-huh. And apparently, I understand from some of the correspondence I've seen from Ken White, that Steger did not like the idea that Shaw had done the Hardboiled Omnibus, and he asked for $100 and half of the royalties over $1,500. Did you ever hear that?
No.
Yeah, that was in some Ken White correspondence. And he just did, and what did that have to do, I wonder, with his being the advisor to new writers? He was an employee, technically, of Popular when he did the Black Mask Omnibus, or the Hardboiled Omnibus. So I don't know, but Steger obviously, of course, Steger was, again, we get back to that thing about not romanticizing. He was a businessman.
Yes, first and foremost.
That's exactly right, yeah. So so he probably got a lot of his clients in the magazine, like Morton Wilson. Where are we going next, pal?
Did we want to move on to Mr. McDonald?
No, what is it, you and John McDonald? Jesus.
You one know, of my favorite authors.
We're supposed to be saving that to the end.
No.
Right? And you do have I know you have a story, a good story about it. But
well, it's okay. We can.
We're going to wartime. We're in wartime.
There you go.
Wartime.
There you go.
And I don't know, again, so much with all the water under the bridge of what we do with this is so much speculation. But I honestly believe that during the war, and if anybody has any. Backing this up or that I'm already
further insight.
Or further insight, yes, that I would love to hear from you. Because I think during World War II, the stories got even softer. They got softer in the relationships, especially between the characters. And I think who were often antagonistic, you think about some of Norbert Davis's characters, how they're always fighting and locking horns. That kind of went away a little in the 40s. Bill Brent is a perfect example. You know, Bill Brent at the very beginning was a hard-boiled newspaper writer who had been forced to become the advice to the Lovelorn columnist at the paper, and he was there only because if he left it, the editor was going to tell everybody and ruin his reputation and never work again. Then in World War II, the motivation becomes different. It's almost like he wants to do this to help people now. I wonder how much of that is the Office of War Information, who, as you know, one of the things that they wanted pulpsters to do was to
was to have characters like Chinese characters that were sympathetic because they were our allies. And so that's how Dr. Zhang, a completely different deal in popular, or I'm sorry, in thrilling group, that's how Dr. Zhang came along by Robert Leslie Bellum and his friend.
You got me. I can't remember your name, Fred.
I know, really. When you have old people on the panel, that's what happens. So I wonder if that's what happened. I have no idea. I have no idea if that's what it was, but if the Office of War Information was saying, look, don't have us fighting one another. We're fighting the Axis. W.T. Ballard's the other guy. We're fighting the Axis. We're not fighting one another.
You know, John, all those pulps you read, preparing our book hasn't come out yet. I've read 100 pulps in my time period, and you notice there's an obvious effort to make all the characters coordinate against a common enemy, which was the Axis.
And not one another. Perfect. Yeah, that's
I mean, even the crooks worked out with the cops to go as a common. They joined forces to go against the Axis.
That's true.
Over a common theme, over and over again.
And over in Street and Smith, Doc Savage was fighting Germans.
That's right. That's exactly right. Okay, we're getting ready now for John D. McDonald. So don't. How about, can you talk about toward the end, after the war, post-war, pulps are starting to die out, and the fellows before us did a nice job with the men's magazine stuff. There was almost a men's sweat magazine type of story that entered in the final years.
We're
supposed to be ready for this, you know, this is John D. McDonald.
Right, so here's, we're going to go past John D., we'll get back to him. Here's Black Mask towards the end, and you can see issue by issue as it was published all the way up to the end, the number of original stories and the number of reprints, and the magazine becomes nothing but reprints practically towards the end, because they were obviously not selling enough issues to make ends meet, so they were essentially becoming a reprint magazine.
When do we talk about John E. McDonald?
Oh, okay.
Jiminy Christmas.
Anyway, so John D. McDonald came in late with Black Mask, and his stuff was very good but dated at the time. Anyway, what I'm relating to is years. A couple of years before he passed, I was negotiating with him to create a book, a reprint book of John D. McDonald stories. And he says, yeah, that sounds like a great idea, but it's going to take a while because I need to update all the stories. And I went, oh, no. We want the stories as they were originally, or I want the stories as they were originally written back in the 40s and stuff. And he was not really complimentary of his, the way I looked at it, he was not complimentary about his own work. So we agreed to disagree, and the book never came about. Except 2 years later, when he publishes Good Old Stuff. And then another year or two after that, more Good Old Stuff. But of course, all of it was updated. And, to me, that just takes away the real feel of the stories as they were written in the 40s. and then it was later, a couple of years obviously after this, actually almost a decade, he comes out with his really famous character, Travis McGee, and then really takes off after that. Unfortunately, John D. McDonald, if you ask anybody who is not a pulp aficionado who John D. McDonald is, they'll look at you with a blank face.
You think now they will?
Yeah.
I'm curious, did his prominently named the cover of most magazines, did he rate the sales when he's on the cover?
I don't think, he first started off writing in Doc Savage magazine.
Right.
As filler. And then, here we have two, both with his name on the cover. So obviously if he was on the cover, his name was big enough to generate information or sales.
Is this the same John D. McDonald that wrote the Travis McGee book?
Right, yes, that's what I said. It was a decade after this that he
I don't think he's quite as unknown as this.
Yeah.
Well, I say that only because I do a lot of shows in which, not pulp shows, I'll do comic shows, or I'll do some other things. And people will ask me, and says, well, this is interesting, what do you do? I say, I sell pulp magazines. And they look at me with, okay, so you sell Stephen King and movie posters about Pulp Fiction? No. And I explain, and I say, look, there's a lot of really great authors out there who've got their start, like John D. McDonald. And they go, they're completely unaware of John D. McDonald. You go into a bookstore now, how many copies of John D. McDonald books do you find on the shelves? I don't see them, unfortunately. Yeah, Rich.
More popular in Britain than he is in the U.S.
Say again?
I think he's more popular in Britain than he is in the U.S.
Yeah.
He produced all, you know, his big PBOs, became hardcovers first over there, Robert Hale, and every people are, you know, Barnes and Noble, like, love John.
Oh yeah, I love John D. McDonald. I mean, yeah, I love his. I've probably read almost every single one of his Travis McGee stories. I mean, to me, him and Dutch Leonard have, you know, really great characters and really great stories. And well, you know, Elmer Leonard started off in the pulp magazines as well. But right. Anyway,
one of the things I've wanted John to do is go ahead and see if he could get the rights to those old stories and reprint them as they were when they first came out in for popular, and I know there's just too many hoops you got to jump through, right?
Yeah, it's not going to happen. I wrote to, and again, it's been too many years now. Whomever I wrote to try to get those rights. A little aside, I actually asked him to come up. I was trying to put together a pulp show in Washington D.C., and I asked him to come up and come to the show as a guest. And he says, that sounds like a great idea, but I have to first go into the hospital for a procedure. And he never made it out of the hospital. So, you know, what could have been, it would have been nice, but anyway.
So at the very end of Black Mask, Kenneth White is let go. Steger takes over for the last few issues as the editor. And like many of the other pulps in the early 1950s, Black Mask dies. Now there were some, of course, some attempts to resuscitate it.
Right, that's the last issue right there, which was actually a smaller issue. It was like halfway between Digest and Pulp size.
Do we have any sales figures on this?
I did not bring any sales figures, no. I don't think the ABC data that I have went up to the end. Okay. But the biggest problem with Popular's ABC figures is that they combined almost all their magazines into a single. So you'd sit there and you'd look at ABC and it shows, you know, 1.4 million copies. Well, obviously they weren't selling 1.4 million of one title. They would combine 12 or 14 titles into one. So, you know, you can't say, well, Black Mask did 1/14 of that. They might have only been 1/10 or 1/5,
you just don't know. I mean, there's right. No way to know.
No way to know.
We've got about 5 minutes left. We'll take a couple of questions or comments if we'd like to hit.
When Ken White took over Dime Detective, one of his big contributions to that magazine was encouraging writers to create series characters who were very distinctive, sometimes eccentric. He brought that same approach to Black Mask. Do you want to mention some of the running characters who were popular during those 1940s?
Well, Olhoff, of course, comes immediately to mind, Inspector Olhoff.
Well, he was Dime Detective.
Dime Detective. You're talking about Black Mask.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I thought you were talking about both of them. Okay. Well, who was it? Was Rex Sackler in Black Mask?
Rex Sackler, yeah.
Yeah, Rex Sackler was in Black Mask. The Penny Pinching Dick was in Black Mask.
Selene Smith.
Selene Smith was a Black Mask character, right? And that was Reeves. And I'm telling you what, Reeves was a terrific writer. He was very underrated. Just an absolutely great writer. I think there's a lot of people who don't like Steve Fisher because they think Fisher was too psychological in his approaches. I love Steve Fisher. I love the Tony Key stories that I just edited the book for Matt. I didn't edit it, I just did the introduction for Matt. The Tony Key stories are terrific. They're different. They're different because they're inside the heads of the characters. You go back to Hammett, you go back to your boy, and there wasn't in their heads. It was now, although your guy would stop and say what was ever on his mind, which was usually something like, yeah, I'm tough. I'm a halfway house between the hoods and the cops.
Right.
You know, something like that. But that was not really deep thinking like you got into with the Steve Fisher character. So, yeah, I'd say Tony Key, certainly, that was a revelation to me to read the Tony Key stories and realize how different they were. I don't know about Gruber. What was Gruber's
blame? He brought Oliver Quaid.
That was Oliver Quaid, the Human Encyclopedia.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
That's right. Earl Constantine, he was...
Yes, yeah.
DL champion.
Yeah, yeah, certainly.
You know, something we didn't mention earlier, like I'll mention right now, there's a huge difference between Black Mask and Dime Detective. That Dime Detective, all stories were complete in that issue, where Black Mask had a history of serials.
That's true.
A very basic fundamental difference between pulps.
That's true.
Through all ages, but that's, you know, I don't know if that was a differential for that, your earlier question on the imprint.
Mm-hmm.
That maybe imprint ran serials and Dime did not run serials.
Yeah, yeah, it's a good point. Anybody else? Yes, yeah, Michelle.
John, I remember my dad, who was a high-ranking naval officer, commander of the flagship during World War II. He was president of the Pearl Harbor Survivors, and he was very emphatic about American togetherness. And he told me that, you talk about the pulps getting softer, mm-hmm. the same thing happened in comic books and movies.
Huh?
And, you know, now there was a certain degree of film noir, especially by PRC and some of the Meyer studios. Mm-hmm. But
that was mostly post-World War II, really, when you think about it.
Well,
yeah.
1946, 1947. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, the American public, my dad told me his main job on the ship and in the harbor at Pearl was to keep the men together. And that was very hard because they had straight men and gay men, they had white men, different versions of white men, mm-hmm. different ethnicities. And they stressed togetherness.
Yeah.
They stressed we're all in this together. This is, we're one people.
Against the Axis.
Against the Axis. Yes, mm-hmm. that was very, very crucial.
Yeah.
And he taught, he was older than most of his people under him. He taught the people on his ships to cooperate with each other. And in fiction, he liked reading stories where people cooperated. You know,
uh-huh.
and a lot of the greatest movies of the wartime period were all about societal cooperation.
We
only have a minute.
We have got a minute left. We got a quick
John.
One.
John.
Yeah, John.
Later, there's a connection with Ellery Queen's magazine. How did that all hook up?
That's a good question. I'm unaware. Thank you.
And we'll admit it, folks. Thank you so much. We appreciate it.
You've been listening to Pulp Tales, fascinating stories of the pulp magazines and the creative minds that brought them to life. Brought to you by The Pulp Net. Learn more about the pulp magazines through articles, blogs, bibliographies, links, over 100 episodes of this podcast, and much more at The Pulp Net. Your link to the pulp magazines for almost 30 years. Online at thepulp.net. Subscribe to Pulp Tales on your favorite podcast platform or listen to us on the web at The Pulp Net. If you enjoy our content, please like us or leave us a review. And tell your fellow pulp fans about Pulp Tales. Thank you for listening and keep reading the pulps. Pulp Tales is copyright 2024 by William P. Lampkin.